Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. Frederick J. Fisher's claims-made insurance, the policy that changed the industry, is an indispensable guide for insurance professionals navigating claims-made policies. This comprehensive book explores the evolution and critical aspects of these policies that have transformed the insurance landscape. Frederick Fisher, Juris Doctor, Certified Claims Professional, is a seasoned expert in professional liability, with a career spanning over 50 years, including 20 as a claims adjuster and owner of a TPA. Renowned for his dedication to client financial security, he advocates for providing clients with a strong financial safeguard. A founding member and past president of over the 40,000-member-strong Professional Liability Underwriting Society, he was awarded their Founders Award in 2019. Now, in addition to his roles in education and advisory, Frederick is a prolific writer and speaker. Over 80 industry-related articles to his name, along with more than 175 industry-related presentations and classes. President of Fisher Consulting Group, founder of ELM Insurance Brokers, his book Claims Made Insurance, The Policy That Changed the Industry, A Deep Dive, Review, and History, has been number one in its category on Amazon. It's called an irreplaceable classic. And author Frederick J. Fisher is our guest on This Week in America. Frederick, welcome to the program. A pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Rick. I do appreciate the opportunity to help not clear the room today and provide some interesting information.
This is such an interesting topic. Let's start with a brief explanation of claims-made insurance, and then talk about, you write about the preventable claim denials increasing. Let's talk about why, but first, just a little background on this type of insurance.
Well, claims-made insurance was something that was developed in or around the mid-1960s, but really didn't catch on until about 1972. And it was really designed to solve a particular problem. Most policies all policies back then, were written what's called an occurrence basis, that the date of the accident had to take place during your policy term. And it's just like driving your car. When you run a red light, or, you know, fail to stop properly and hit somebody, two things happen. Number one, somebody's immediately injured. It may not know to the extent, but they're immediately injured, and you know that. And usually the first thing out of your mouth, oh, thank goodness my policy just renewed last month, I'm covered, I don't have to worry about it. In other words, those policies that were written and still are on the current basis only required that the accident take place during the policy term, and for good reason. The injury is usually immediate, and the person injured knows they're injured. And so it doesn't take long for them to do whatever they're going to do in making a claim against you or hiring a lawyer, et cetera. However, that's not true of professionals in many instances. Granted, you know, medical professionals, if they make a mistake, the injury may be immediate, but not always. But when it comes to architects and engineers, accountants, lawyers, insurance agents and brokers, real estate agents and brokers, when they make an error, a professional mistake, nobody may know about it. Nobody may even be injured right away. And that may take a long time. For instance, maybe an architect and an engineer makes a mistake on the load factor on a pedestrian bridge over a major highway or over a major thoroughfare at the airport, for instance. And, you know, it may take years for that to fail.
Yes.
And collapse and hurt people. So on the current basis, the policy would be triggered by the date of the error, although that's slowly changing. But still, the date the mistake was made is when that triggers the policy. But if the event doesn't happen for 20 or 30 years, number one, actuaries can't really close the books, even though they chose 5 years to do so. So they really don't know that there may be other claims out there they don't know about. Number two, the professional, he's going to have to keep a copy of all of his policies for 20 or 30 years. He's also going to have to keep all of his files. That's a lot of storage.
That is a lot of storage.
Claims-made policy solved that problem. In that policy, when it was originally introduced, really had two requirements. Number one, that the claim by the injured party, that claim against the professional had to first take place during the policy term. And so the error, or when that error mistake took place wasn't as important when these policies were first introduced. And the only other requirement was that nobody knew they had made an error. None of the policyholder or policyholders knew that there was a possibility of a claim being made, because they have to, that's a warranty on the application, that they're not aware of any mistake that could give rise to a claim later in the future. Well, by 1972, that concept kind of took off. And there was a managing underwriter for a major carrier, and they were writing accountants and architects and engineers and lawyers and real estate brokers and insurance brokers and what have you on a claims-made basis. And so the theory was, when the policy ends, there's not going to be any made, nobody can make a claim against you that would be covered under that policy. And so it made it easier for the actuaries to determine what the experience might be and adjust pricing and coverage and what have you. And as a result, some carriers tested the market back in those days. They had two policies for, like, lawyers, an occurrence form and a claims made form. Which one do you think was cheaper? The claims made form.
Yes.
And it expanded from there. Originally, the only trigger, the only necessity for a trigger was that, you know, the claim be first made against the insured during the policy term and must arise, or no insured was aware of a potential claim. That's it. Now there's five triggers. And it's gotten much more complicated. And because of that, more and more claims are unnecessarily being denied because the policyholder didn't report the claim on a timely basis, or they didn't answer a question, a warranty question on the application honestly. They thought, oh, I can get that problem fixed, so it's really not a problem. Well, and then when they fail to get it fixed 2 years later, when the claim is made, they're going to have that claim denied because they misrepresented the situation on their application for insurance. And it's happening with more and more frequency, a tremendous amount, as a matter of fact. I did an article just a few years ago. We're looking at 224 denials. I agreed with every single one of them. Oh, they were all correct. The largest single group of policyholders, though, that had their claims denied was, guess who?
Lawyers. So that winked that one.
Lawyers. The second largest group were directors and officers. Like, you know, if you own a corporation, if you're a corporate officer, it doesn't matter whether it's publicly traded or not. You can still be sued by third parties, even in privately held corporations or LLCs. And they're the second largest group of people that had their claims denied for late reporting or not disclosing potential problems. And why? Because when a director and officer gets sued, what do? They more often than not turn it over to their corporate counsel. The two, it was 46% of all claims. And since then, there have been since that article came out in 2023, there have been 50 more denials. And every one of them was preventable, every single one of them.
This book is so important. Yeah, this book is so important because you really laid this out there. I'm reading reviews. I'm reading articles that you have written, much more complicated than we understand. But it's important because a misstep cost you literally thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Or millions. And part of the problem today is that, number one, you can't rely on your insurance producer or the insurance broker you're working with, and I don't care how long you've been working with them. You can't rely on them because in 37 states, they have no duty to advise you. It's called the order taker standard of care. They have no more obligation to advise you on coverage or what may be appropriate for you than your server at Denny's. Wow. And yet they're the guys that are licensed. They're the people that had to take a course on insurance 40 hours in many instances before they could even apply for a license. They're the ones that have to take continuing education classes, and you don't. But the law expects you to not only read the policy, but also understand it. Now, how absurd is that? The states, it's easier to tell you which states don't follow that.
Yeah, it's with 37 of them in that category.
Yeah, Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Michigan, Montana, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Washington, D.C., and West Virginia. Now, two states actually hold producers to a fiduciary standard of care, the highest standard of care around. Well, the same standard of care that lawyers are held up to. And that's Florida. They did that by common law. And New Jersey did it by statute.
Interesting.
And then the other states have varying degrees of looking at what they call the entire relationship, which is synonymous with totality of circumstances. But that's how they look at it, including maybe the length of the relationship. That can trigger it too. But that's usually 10 years or more. And then there might be a higher standard for those agents as they gain what they call intimate knowledge of your needs. But for the most part, you can't rely on your insurance agent. You certainly can't rely on a captive agent, somebody who could only write with a specific insurance company. And the problems with that go far beyond professional liability and professionals and director and officers and employment practice policies, which are also written on a claims-made basis. It applies to everybody.
Interesting, yes.
I mean, how many people realize that on their homeowner policy or their condo policy, they may not have adequate coverage for complete rebuilding, or replacement cost? How many of them don't realize that you're not entitled to be paid for improvements? So you're not going to go from Corian counters to granite. The insurance company doesn't have to pay for that. They only have to replace the Corian, so to speak. You can't go from carpet to hardwood floors if you didn't already have hardwood floors originally, that sort of thing. But another important thing that is considered an improvement is building code upgrades. Don't take those lightly. My house is 70 years old. You can imagine that if my house burned down today and it had to be rebuilt, how much of that cost is going to be more expensive because now the house has to be rebuilt to current building codes. That is a separate limit on your homeowner policy. Most people don't even know about it. It's 10%, usually 10% of the fire is the standard. So if you have $500,000 in fire coverage, you've only got $50,000 for code and ordinance, which, depending on where you live, may be terribly inadequate, especially if building codes have gotten upgraded to be able to withstand, 110-mile-hour winds of a hurricane or a tornado, or electrical codes and what have you. In Malibu, for instance, there's a $15,000 cost right up front because now they want a soils engineer to come out and do a testing of the soil to see if it's compact enough to handle the weight of the foundation and the weight of the house or the property that you're going to be building. That's a $15,000 cost right there. And nobody tells you that. Or debris removal the big one. How much money you get to live in temporary housing or temporary apartment?
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's called an additional living expense. Is it limited to a time limit, 6 months or a year, 2 years, unlimited? Or is it, if you can find it today, actual loss sustained, which means it's basically unlimited as long as you're not trying to prolong living in that nice new apartment, temporarily, but it's actual loss sustained.
And you're saying that's difficult to find a policy that does that, that gives you unlimited access to a place while they're rebuilding yours.
Yeah, it's exactly right. But how much coverage do you have? That's, most people don't even know that exists.
No, and I'm sure as people are listening, they're thinking, I better do a little checking here because he's touching on areas that impact my life. This is why millions of these policies are sold every year. And you say, rather than being easy in addressing these problems, they're becoming more complicated. Why is that? Too many lawyers rewriting these?
Well, it's done for profit. A lot of insurance companies have forgotten what their mission is, which is to put people back in the position they were in before the loss. That's the basic concept of insurance. That puts you back in the position you were in before the loss. More and more, and I don't like citing names, but in articles I do, but I won't do it today. I know three law firms that have actually written articles in the trade journals and what have you, where they're actively promoting limiting coverage even more.
Wow.
I'm not joking when I say that. One attorney believes in using a lot of what are called absolute exclusions. Another law firm wrote an article about how director and officer liability policies are pretty expensive. A hard market that lasted maybe 2 years, but he promoted and listed out in an article 19 different exclusions that should be added to the policy. 19. And then he also wanted all of the exclusions to be using what's called absolute language. It's the most dangerous language out there. And it's very broad. I mean, really broad. And one federal court judge actually said in an opinion enforcing an absolute exclusion in a D&O policy, we are about to enforce a staggeringly broad exclusion. For a judge to say that?
Yes.
I grew up with the maxim that, you know, insuring agreements are to be broadly construed and are broadly interpreted and exclusions narrowly construed. That's out the window now. Out the window.
And now they're loading one.
Contracts of adhesion, an unfair bargaining position. That's out the window as well.
How does a policyholder protect themselves?
Well, number one, you got to force your insurance producer to work with you. You got to put it in writing to him. Here's what I need you to do with me. The phrase, I want to be completely covered. I want to be covered for everything.
Yes.
Blah, blah, blah. That's considered too broad a statement to be realistic or be the courts to look at. What you want to do is, I want you to sit down and work with me and go over the policy with me. What do I need to know? And then make decisions accordingly. Now, I don't know any insurance producer, including myself when I was one, I would never recommend limits, ever. Because for any limit I suggest, I can think of a situation where you need more.
Okay, yes.
But here's what you could do. Get ballparks. What's it going to cost to do this? What's it going to cost to do that? Give me an idea. So then you can make an informed decision on, number one, what you can afford and what works for you. But that's important. You got to make your broker do it, and do it in writing. Make it to you and keep a record of it, what your expectations are. Some of you may work with a semi-captive insurance company where their independent agents, you know, have to give them first right of refusal. And then if the company doesn't want to write the business, they can go elsewhere if they're properly licensed. But, you know, I won't mention names now, but they do advertise an annual review. They're supposed to conduct an annual review with you. Take that seriously and do it, because you're talking about your financial protection. I can pretty much assure you that with the massive LA fires that we had this year, earlier this year in January, where 18,000 homes were destroyed or more, and this including Malibu, and then you had other areas that were equally affected, I can guarantee you the significant number of those homes were underinsured. And to some extent, you may not even know how bad, because with the pressure on supplies, I don't have a clue what the price per square foot for ordinary construction is in Southern California right now.
Yes.
And it can vary from month to month.
Well, and you talk about, finish that thought. Go ahead.
Well, there's a matter in Hawaii, for instance, where a condo complex was completely destroyed in the Maui fire. And originally they thought that maybe $50 million in coverage would be appropriate. And now it turns out it's going to cost closer to $200 million to replace it. But that is not that. That's unusual. And the reason being is that, number one, everything has to be shipped in. So that's going to significantly increase the cost right there. And then, of course, the supply. You got the supply problem when you consider how many properties were destroyed in that fire. It's unbelievable. So you can't anticipate that. So even if you think you are properly covered, and you may actually be, if it's just one house in your neighborhood gets burned down, that's one thing. But if a tornado comes along and destroys, 400 homes at once, now that's a different story. And I don't know how anybody can really anticipate that. I don't.
A fascinating conversation with our guest on the program, Frederick J. Fisher. The book is Claims Made Insurance, The Policy That Changed the Industry, A Deep Dive, Review, and History. Book available wherever books are sold. Frederick's website is fishercg.com. We have a link on that on our website. You'll go directly to his website. Information on the book, order it, get all the information there. It's interesting. I'm reading about cyber liability, environmental liability. How has that changed, where factors like that maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you wouldn't even mention? Now they're an important part, I would assume, of your policy.
Oh, absolutely. Environmental is very important, especially for business owners and engineers and people in the environmental industry, because it's not going to be covered under your CGL policy. You've got to get a special coverage for environmental exposures. And it is a liability policy, but it can also be first party, especially when you're building a 50-story office building in downtown Los Angeles and your excavation has to go down 100 or 200 feet. You can imagine the PCBs that may be down there. And so you're going to have to do an environmental cleanup before you can even finish construction. So these, again, you got to work with a knowledgeable insurance producer that knows what the heck they're doing. Not your brother-in-law, not somebody necessarily that you've been working with for the last 20 years. This kind of stuff may be out of their league. And brings up an interesting point as well. You'd be surprised how many retail brokers, the insurance producer that works directly with the policyholder, how often they use an intermediary. A wholesale broker or what have you. You don't necessarily know that, but it's a good idea because there's two reasons to use an intermediary: access to markets that the retail producer can get to on their own, and they may have expertise the retail broker doesn't have. So here's what you need to do as the consumer. When you put your needs in writing and what your expectations are, give your insurance producer the right to use an intermediary if he needs to.
Okay.
That's important because now it may create a degree of privity of contract between you and the wholesaler, because wholesalers like to say, I don't owe an obligation to anybody. I'm just a conduit. I just get an app in and send it into an insurance company and get a quote and send it out. And yet they also advertise how expert they are.
Yes. There's more to it than just selling insurance, isn't there?
Oh, the courts more and more are saying you should have read the policy. Really? You're going to read an 86-page policy and understand it? I mean, I know lawyers can't do that. If they did, they wouldn't have as many of their claims denied.
Fascinating.
But you can try. And there's some things that are obvious. Maybe the address is wrong. Double-check the limits. Make sure it's what you wanted. And whether it's even adequate. Never take that for granted.
And it seems like
unfortunately, too many more are, especially when you've got lawyers actively helping insurance companies draft policy language to be able to deny claims. And I've got copies of the articles doing that. And even, you know, we could have a debate about the supply side versus the consumer and all that. And that's fine. We could have that conversation if you'd like. However, let's not forget one thing, and that is suppliers are also consumers, and they're getting burned by this too. I can name a number of corporations that thought they had proper coverage and didn't. One of them was Pharmacia Corporation. They had to cover $47 million of a settlement they got approval for. Their insurance company said, you can settle this claim. They approved the amount. And then one of the excess carriers, because corporations like that have towers of excess liability insurance, the sixth layer of excess had a policy that required not only had to do all underlying insurers, all the insurance companies below our 100, we started the 160 million. We want to see 160 million on the table before we'll tender our money towards this $207 million settlement. And they gave prior approval. Problem was their policy had two conditions. Number one, all underlying insurers had to have their money on the table. And here's the killer. All underlying insurers had to admit liability. Not the insured, mind you. Not Pharmacia. The insurance companies.
Wow.
They had to admit liability. Whoever does that? I've never heard of such a thing. And yet that language was upheld as being clear and unambiguous. And Pharmacia had to cover $47 million of a $207 million settlement because of it.
There's a lack of standardization. You've written about that. You talked about that. You've got the 37 states doing one thing. You've got the 13 doing something else. How important is it likely that someday we'll have this standardized across the country so everybody is dealing basically from the same playbook?
You probably won't because it's an interference to write a contract. But here's why this is so important. Everybody is being brainwashed, buy on price, buy on price, buy on price. Never buy on price, because you're not going to be covered. I'm just telling you that right now.
Yes.
You're giving up something. No two policies are alike, not your auto home or homeowners. You know, Allstate's policy may be different than Farmers and different than, you know, State Farms, etc. They don't have to be identical. They can modify forms that are being produced, you know, written for everybody by the ISO, Insurance Services Office. They can modify them however they want. And number two, they may have different standard limits and whatever, and they may have, you know, additional things, you know, that one company does that another one doesn't. The departments of insurance mainly set forth minimums, what they must do. After that, they can do whatever they want as long as they get approval by the Department of Insurance. If they're an admitted carrier, they have to get pre-approval on their forms before they're allowed to write. So you can't believe that, oh, my auto insurance is no different than anybody else's, and now I'm just looking for price. Boy, that is so wrong. And they are brainwashing you to think that. Oh, I just saved $300 on my auto insurance and $400 on my homeowner. It's you're giving something up is what I'm trying to tell you. And more importantly, and here's the kicker, you know, they're also counting on that placebo effect. Here's your policy, you know, Mr. Smith. Don't you feel good doing business with me? I just saved you $400. And you say, oh, wow, yeah, until you have a claim. And that's not when you want a surprise.
No, it's not. And there is so much here. The book is really, it's been called a masterpiece. And you can see why it's been number one on Amazon. Claims Made Insurance, the policy that changed the industry, a deep dive review in history. So much to talk about, so little time to do it. You've talked about the entry of private equity companies is rising. We see them.
Oh, my God, yes. Number one, just to be clear, the Claims Made book is written for professionals, anybody who, from a business standpoint, is providing a service to someone else as a fee. And that includes consultants, podcasters, your media liability policies written on a claims made basis, you know, Rick. And don't take that for granted. But it's written for business people that provide a service for a fee, like accountants and architects and lawyers and consultants of all kinds. There's over 200 different types of consultants. So you take that for, you know, you got to remember that too. But I wrote it for the consumer. It's not written for lawyers. It's not written for architects and engineers. It is written for them, the consumer. It's not written for people in the insurance industry. They'll certainly benefit from it, no doubt.
Yes.
It's written for the guys paying for the policy. You need to know what's in this book because it may make the difference between you being covered and not covered. And you never know until you have a claim and submit it. You can't even ask an underwriter anymore. I read this policy. I have a problem with this language. If the following circumstance takes place, would it be covered? And they may say yes or no, but it's irrelevant. They're not the claim department. When you submit the claim to the claim department, they're going to say, sorry, you're not covered. And that will be upheld.
That I'm just absorbing all of this. We think it's so simple. We get the lowest price. We turn it in. We're covered. Life goes on. We're fine. If something happens, we're covered. Finding out that's not necessarily the case. The book is easy to read. As you're talking to Frederick, you understand what he's talking about. He has a writing style that's you understand what he's writing about. It's very clear. It's very understandable. A couple minutes left in this program, and hopefully we can do this again because there's so many different areas to talk about. Do you see it being corrected? Do you see this eventually going to a point where it's easier to understand and you don't need, you say, beware of the nuances. Can we eliminate some of the nuances?
The only way that's going to be done is legislatively. I don't think the courts are going to do it because so many maxims of insurance, like I said, that I grew up with have been thrown out the window. Where, like I said, insuring agreements are going to be broadly interpreted and exclusions narrowly construed, or the concept that there's an unfair bargaining position between the policyholder and the insurer, and that insurance contracts are contracts of adhesion as a matter of law. That's out the window. And because this fanatic, it's almost obsessive belief in the sanctity of the written contract. And if it's clear and unambiguous, the language will be enforced, which begs the question, unambiguous to who? Lawyers?
Yes.
Judges? And you're going to hold a policyholder to that level? I'm not allowed to, I do expert witness testimony now. I'm semi-retired. I am not allowed to interpret an insurance policy in court. I am not allowed to do it. Only a court can interpret a policy and interpret the intent. So, do they expect you to do that? That makes no sense to me.
It's so fascinating. There are so many nuances that we have not even touched on during the course of the conversation, and there's plenty there to continue. Claims
have
made.
Me back anytime.
I would. It's interesting. Claims Made Insurance, the policy that changed the industry, a deep dive review in history by Frederick J. Fisher. Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R. His website is very simple. FisherCG.com. Book available at Amazon, all the usual places. I'd like to thank ChristianWorksMedia.com for arranging a conversation today. They're dedicated to helping authors promote and their creations and their services. Thank them for our conversation today. Frederick, it's been a pleasure. So much more to talk about. We definitely will have to do this again. Thank you for being with us on the program. and scaring us. We'll all go back and winter with our policy now. You know, I got $300 off on my policy rather than the neighbor. I got the better deal. Not necessarily the case. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And you know, now you know why they call me a coverage terrorist.
I love the approach. You've got my attention, and it's going, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know that during the course of the conversation today. All the information, of course, on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. And we are back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.